Welcome to Frame One. I'm Dryson, and if you're watching this, you probably noticed something a little bit different. I'm by myself. And that's because this is the season finale of Frame One. I want to take an episode dedicated just to looking back on the incredible conversations that I've had with some of my favorite human beings and, dare I say, friends in the motion design industry over the past 12 months. And to really get into that, I want to share where Frame One came from and why it's even a thing, because Frame One was not my idea. In fact, it was Camp MoGraph in Virginia, 2022. I had conversations with Dave Swain and Amanda Russell at Cream Studio, along with Nick Campbell from Grayscale Gorilla. And after those conversations, they were like, Dryson, you got a good voice. You should do something with it. And Frame One was almost started on a dare. At the same time, my business partner, Courtney Haberl, and I, we were talking about starting an animation studio together. And both of us had been around production from design and video, but neither one of us had actually worked in a true animation studio. And so we wanted to talk to our heroes and feel, because not every single business startup is a success story. I don't think it's a secret. So we wanted to know the people that made it, the people that accomplished what it was that we hope to do. How did they feel when they were first starting? And if we could gain any insights and business tips to running our studio to give us the best foot forward and just help identify the characteristics that we needed to find in ourselves to make sure we could find success, that was going to be an amazing thing for us. So one question we always had was confidence. When people start their studio, how did they feel? Were they confident? And so I want to dive into that right now.
What I kept coming back to was, I will make it work. Like, I have a track record of making things work, you know? And if it doesn't work, if worst case scenario, like, I just fail and it's a fiery mess, I'm not leaving on a bad note. These people are supportive of me. And I bet if I came back a year from now and said, that was stupid, do you have an opening for me? Or do you know of someone? Or could I put your...
You could have an
you
in.
Know, yeah.
Get back
can
in.
I put my name on your list or whatever? I feel like there would be an open door. And so I actually felt confident that I would make it work, even if making it work meant finding another full-time job.
It's hard to go from a place where you're comfortable to a place where you're constantly worried, you know?
Let me rephrase that in a different way then. How did you know that leaving the safety... a full-time job mm-hmm. was the right call.
I didn't.
You weren't making a mistake.
I didn't. You just have to have, you have to have kind of faith in yourself,
yep.
faith in that, like, you know, your skills are good enough, you know, that you can network well enough and that you can, that your work is decent enough to where you can bring in some, you know, some
but you
work.
You gotta have money in the bank.
I think you were the first one that said, oh, we should probably start a studio someday. And he mentioned that you had said that to him. And I'm like, well, that's it. It's going to happen.
It was just sort of wild. Like, we really committed to this thing. And we're like, yeah, let's just do it. And I told my wife, she's like, well, have you met them? Or like, she's like, she's asking all the questions that I should, you know, should have been in my head. But, you know, just sort of had to explain, like, no, I know this is different. I know that this is the real deal. I don't know. It was a weird instinct.
How did you guys feel day one?
I know, like, I'll figure it out. I didn't know how fast it would grow. But, you know, the first day I was like, yeah, we can do this. We can figure it out. We can make videos. We can make money doing this. And then we sold, like, our first set of, like, 10 videos for, like, $3,000.
Confidence level wise, it's hard to go back, you know, to that person that long ago. But one of our biggest strengths can also be a weakness sometimes. And it's what he said, like, we're hyper confident in the things that we can achieve things. But it's not like pride. It's just because we know we're going to figure it. We're going to do whatever
you,
it takes.
You have the drive to
we
put
will
in the
not
time,
stop.
The energy, whatever.
Yeah.
People who are starting out and they think, oh, I got to start small and so forth. I'm like, yes. However, you really owe it to yourself to make a little bit of time and space and swing for the fences. And that was how, like, I just kind of propelled my company right out of the starting gates. The answer is, I mean, a combination of confidence, I don't know, a little bit of bravado, maybe a little bit of ego, maybe a little bit of naivete, you know? Because by the time the project was done and I added up all the numbers, I did okay, but yeah. Wow, it was way more work than I expected it was going
to
be.
At what point did you feel comfortable and confident enough to say, yes, we as Lemony are good enough, we're going to approach national big name companies like this and actually chase these accounts?
Yeah, I would say either never or always. gaining confidence that you're good at what you do is one of the hardest things of being a creative or a solopreneur or running a studio. And sometimes you need those little benchmarks or checkpoints to meet others and be like, yeah, I got this. So I think that's a huge part, is your mindset and belief of your ability.
You do feel comfortable and confident for small windows at a time. And those are great little windows, but you learn from the other windows. So I think it just, like, it's a cycle, and you get comfortable in that cycle and you kind of start to learn, oh, this, when I feel this way, this is when I'm growing. When I feel this way, this is when I've hit my stride, and that's great. And then I'll probably have more learning to do later.
We think that confidence is going to come, like, before we do whatever it is, wanting to create a better gym routine or eat healthier or do more public speaking. Like, we think that confidence will show up on our doorstep, and then we can do that thing, right? Then we can say hi to the person who passes us in the mall, whatever it might be. But confidence actually comes after, and confidence is a muscle that you build over time. So you have to start doing the thing if you want to get more confident doing that thing.
A common thread I found from everyone was that, yes, they were confident that they were going to be able to make this work and figure it out. But how did that feel moving from full-time employee to freelance, or from freelance to studio owner? Let's find out.
I had been kind of flirting with the idea of freelance for a little bit,
okay,
knowing I'm going to have to move and I can't work in-house anywhere where I'm going to move.
Right.
So I had kind of spent those last few months at my job, like, really intentionally absorbing, like, how does my producer talk to clients and how does my creative director talk to clients? And so from there, it was a lot of, like, Chris Doe's podcast. It was a lot of the Chutzpah freelance book that got me through Joey Kornman's book. And so a lot of those resources kind of made me feel like I had, like, studied for the test.
You know, we essentially started, and I think a lot of people that do what we do start this way, right? You start as a freelancer because you're good at doing, you know, the thing that you're good at doing. And you sort of operate with that mindset. You know, like you were just saying, it's like, okay, great. Now we have this work. Now how are we going to get it done?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you're just calling friends, right? And I think it's really easy to, you know, start off in, like, all right, well, like, maybe it's a freelance collective, or maybe, you know, it's like, it's a company, but really it's like, we're
all
a collection.
Working together. We're friends. We're doing
things. Yeah, exactly. But as things start to grow, you start to see, like, the importance of setting, you know, expectations, like, okay, well, like, what's your job? What's my job? Like, can we get paid for stuff? Like, what do you get paid? What do I get paid?
It took a while before I feel like, I don't know, we were taken, like, really, really seriously as a studio by the local agencies.
Probably because we had freelanced with them before, so they kind of just saw us all as a group of freelancers.
Right, and really honestly, we kind of acted that way for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the things that I learned running a freelance business translated, you know, moved those things over just as far as, like, kind of the structure of your company and taxes and those kinds of things. And even just, like, software for invoicing, you know, all that kind of stuff that you sort of have to do. But, like, once you start a real studio, once you have a brick and mortar, once you have partners, once you have operating agreements, once you have all these things that come together that make it more than just being a one-man show kind of thing, it's not like it grows. It's, like, a little bit harder. It's a lot harder. There's so many things you just don't know.
Matt started a burn sheet.
We kind of had our own clients, but we'd work together on projects and stuff like that. And he'd be like, oh, we got this one coming in. We got this one coming in. And he'd tell me all these, and then I'd forget them. You know, it just, oh, cool. Whoa, all right. Now on to the next thing, right? So what I did was I created the burn sheet, where it's basically, okay, this is how much money we have. These are the projects that are coming in, you know. This is payroll and stuff that we know we've got.
All the expenses you're going to have.
It's just like five columns in Excel, you know.
It's basically, but when are we going to go out of business?
When are we running out of money?
And the decision that we made is that we were going to do a paycheck every 2 weeks, mm-hmm, for each of us, and it was always going to be this amount. So you put that in there and you put that on the chart as well, so that you know exactly when can you stop paying yourself. And that's the big thing. And that way you always have this regular paycheck. We're not doing a gig and saying, oh, let's just split all that money and not think about cash flow or anything else. To keep the rest of your money there and to have a plan and like just not just go up and down. You can have your own personal budget if you know you're going to get that exact amount of money every 2 weeks.
Having that peace of mind to know what's coming in and what's going out is kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Especially you're making a leap to not having a stable job.
You need to have something on paper. It's like, oh, this is me and my buddy. We're doing stuff. All right, like, let's go get the lawyers or let's get on LegalZoom and let's write this stuff up. That doesn't feel good to me.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't feel like the natural thing to do, or it feels like, are we
planning for our failure?
Exactly. Or it's like signing a prenup or something like that, you know?
We're going to be best friends forever.
It's like, don't you trust me? It's like, well, don't you trust me? You know?
But
it's for the same reason that you have contracts with your clients, right? Because what does a contract do? It sets expectations. It's vital to have some kind of a document that tells you what to do.
Yeah.
Because humans, we'll either want to get mad about something or we'll want to acquiesce and be really nice. And it's like, oh, it's my bro. So
right.
And having something on paper kind of takes that.
It takes the ambiguity out of it. Do you think that you could run a studio of this caliber if you only had freelancers?
I think people are trying to. And so therefore, I do think you can, but I do think things are lost. There's like somebody like Steven Anderson, who's my managing director. He knows this place as well as I do. If something comes up from like 4 years ago, he's going to know exactly who worked on it. Like there's just efficiencies lost by having to staff up every time. And a lot of our work is repeat business. So like when they call us, they expect that the people navigating the job with them like understand historically what have happened. They understand like not only do we know brand standards and this and that, but if they're referenced something, like we don't have to go dig it up and unarchive it. The person knows what they're talking about.
Right.
We can have that conversation. All of that stuff would be lost if you had to staff up every single job.
One solution is scale.
Yeah.
Honestly. But
that's a scary financial investment.
It's very scary. And that's why a lot of people don't do it, because you're like, oh, how am I? I can't afford that much overhead. I guarantee there are many studios that would say, yeah, we have certain kind of repeat freelancers or permalancers that we work with quite a lot on a monthly basis. And so it's sort of like, guess what? You're already like you're paying a salary, like you can't afford it. I think it's scary, though, because, you know, when you're, in a project based business, well, you're bringing those freelancers on to like
that one project.
Right. So you've got this project and that has a budget, and that's how you're affording to pay that person. And so then you think, like, well, what about all those other time?
So rather than being the guy in the chair that was doing the 3D all the time now and the guy that was doing all the editing and the whatever, I was able to go out and start meeting people, building relationships. But my being able to focus and not wear 32 hats, I remember one time listing all of the different things it took for me to run my business and being able to say, let's just get that down to 12 and then maybe six things and then maybe someday three or four things.
You know, people say that, you know, isn't it great working for yourself? But like the real reality is you have even more clients because your team is dependent on you and your clients are dependent on you. And I'm going to use this analogy, even though it's not like when you start a boutique company, it's like you're not the mill or the frame store, right? Like as the owner, people know who you are and they're going to call you. That's why they're working with you. Like if I'm working with Frame Store or the mill, like who is even the owner? Who do I call if I want to bitch about something?
Right.
Or if I'm not happy with my team or something's not going well, who do I even want to call if something's going great? So I think like, the romantic idea of opening a studio is like just that. It's a romantic idea. But there are some major things. But I would say like go into it with like a balanced notion of what it's going to be. And I think the big things are is have a lot of money saved up. Have money saved, because cash flow is something that you don't think about and nobody talks to you about. At any given time, half of your receivables can be over 60 days.
Yep.
Late. So that means, like, if you paid out all your freelancers and everything in 45 days, for as long as they're going, you're basically funding organizations. And, like, you can't make money magically appear. No matter how many times you call them, they're going to send you the money when they send you the money. So you have to be very conservative with money, and you have to have a lot of cash saved up.
What it looked like for me, and not thinking about things from a business perspective, is I got burnt out. Like,
yeah,
I was
boundaries, work life,
right? It's like it work life boundaries and interpersonal boundaries, and, you know, working with friends, and like all of those things can get complicated. I don't think they have to. I think that there's absolutely a way that you can do it. Communication is everything, you know, and the moment that you feel like, I think there's a vibe here, like we need to like press into that and see what might be going on there. Maybe it's nothing.
Yeah.
Or maybe this is something that we actually need to address and talk about. And again, for a lot of this stuff, if you have it, you know, if you have a, you know, contract of some sort, then it's like, there's no emotion in that. It's just like, well, this is what it is. We agreed to it. So
as I've come to learn, starting a studio is so much work. Everything from branding to relationships, all of it really adds up. So let's dive into a little bit of the hardships of owning a studio.
You're not fighting, but like you're not agreeing about something right now. And yeah, it can be frustrating in the moment. But then like knowing that you'll come back and go, you know what, I'm still very, very lucky to have these two people as my partners.
I think that at first, things would get kind of heated because, first of all, we didn't know how to run a business. We were scared. We were younger and immature, and we didn't know how to solve those little quarrels. But over time, you start realizing, like, this is just a little blip. This is just a little thing. We've done this before. And it takes that experience to help you realize when it's happening.
I would say that's like one of the hardest aspects of running a business, especially a business like this. Like, nothing's retainer. There's just relationships. But like, there was a point in our evolution where we had two big main clients, and within the same year, both those agencies lost that business, which means that business goes away for us too, and nothing that we did. It's just like, so you really have to learn to diversify and to, even if you're small enough where you just need two main clients, you have to have an iron in all the fires to be having yet another two clients, because those two could go away.
Well, there was a time I always tell now as a coach with services companies, you got to be careful to let one client be too large.
Right. We want to diversify a little bit.
Exactly. So one year they were about 44% of our business. That's a lot.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And so the hope was to dilute it by growing others. An event we were working on it, and then they did really pull down one year. So I think that's probably in the second half of Lemonly where I gained a more appreciation for leadership, and the burden that an entrepreneur carries. Because when you get off that phone call internally inside a room by yourself, a lot of thoughts are running through your head of, can I pay these people? Are we going to make it? Will we survive? Did I just turn something that was valuable into something that's no longer valuable? You know, you always kind of go to bed thinking the whole thing's just going to fall apart.
Absolutely.
And I think that's pretty common for entrepreneurs. But then you step out of the building or out of that room, and everyone's working and just doing their job and doing what you're asking them to do. And you kind of got to just show up and be there for them and be the person that they need you to be, right?
A support system is so important. It's a very lonely journey as a CEO, as a founder, as an entrepreneur, whatever you want to put that title on. And your support system, especially if it's people who are in your same shoes, I think if you're with other entrepreneurs, like my husband, Doug, is that they can put themselves in your shoes too. And they've been through a lot of the same things you've been through. And I think that's where leaning into people who are like-minded. And I think that's also when starting a business, there's not really a finish line. It's not really a marathon. It's an ongoing, continually improving evolution.
I love that.
Weirdly, I'm very nerdy with spreadsheets as well as like general like technology stuff and creative software. So to me, it's always like a certain point when like when I'm spending so much money and I'm hiring different people to do the same thing. It's a good time for me to hire, like find the one person who's a good fit for the team to, I don't want to say replace all the other people, but like, you know, if I'm consistently hiring a freelancer to do character animation, you know, month after month on end, like maybe it's a good idea for me to bring that skill set in-house, because I always hate, like, I love working with a variety of people, and we're still, you know, right now it's about, we're like 15 people, but we're probably closer to like 30, 35 every month in terms of like contractors and other stuff.
Yeah.
But I always get to this point where it's like, I hate to see the knowledge go out the door, you know, because we work through some hard things. You figure out how to accomplish a job or, you know, make different technology work together, and then all of a sudden it's like, that was cool and that was a fun 8 weeks, but then they're gone somewhere else, and like maybe you work with them a couple months later, maybe it takes 2 years because they're busy. So that's a big thing. I was always like trying to see like weigh the level of work and the volume, I guess, based upon what the needs are and what I would like to add to the team. You know, there's only so much I can do.
Yeah.
And I do mostly like on the business development and like sales side now. So there's only so much that can happen there. And then when you bring in and add another person into the puzzle, it's just constantly like, you know, we look at it as like a sandbox and it's like another toy to play with.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's a toy you have all the time, right? And it's like someone, you know, like an editor can work with a character animator. But if we don't have an editor, it's really hard to like get that combination of things together, because then you're just going out of, you know, out of house for it.
And then I assume like when you have a freelancer or have to hire a freelancer, there has to be project and money coming in, as opposed to now if you have that resource on staff, there are going to be idle times, hopefully not too long of idle times, but now those resources can be dedicated to help building up Spilt either through social or for other odds and ends.
Totally.
I'll never forget it. This was like one of those pivotal moments. He said, the way I see it, you have three choices. You can keep doing what you're doing, ride hard, burn out. You can hope that someone else will pay you to do what you're doing now and pay you the same that you're making now. Or third option, you can change the way that you're doing things.
I mean, that was the question I had going to Camp Mograph this year was, do I start a studio? Do I keep freelancing or find someone else that I can work for instead?
Yeah.
So I get it. It's a hard question.
It's a very difficult question because it gets at the core of what you're wired for.
Yeah.
You know, because like, not everybody is wired to run a business, and that's okay. I do think it takes a lot of self-exploration to know what that right answer is for you.
Yeah.
There's not a wrong answer, but it also, it is very easy to answer the question incorrectly or to have not done the self-exploration.
And just put an answer out there.
When you're on that journey and you're in that 7 years, you're like, shit, I know I'm capable of something greater. I feel called to make it. It's this thing that just, it drives me. And at times it drives me crazy. At times it drives the people that I love crazy because I have this sort of obsession.
Absolutely.
Right? And it's not just producing the great work, but it's also generating great money. And it's generating the like attention and respect that you know, I don't want to say you deserve.
It can almost be an addiction.
Yeah.
Chasing that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so when you start to finally scratch that itch and enjoy some of that satisfaction, that's a cool season of your business.
That's been a big thing for us this past year is the team communication.
Yeah.
We've been able to like have good moments of that. We've had moments where we've learned from it and had to communicate better. And we always, as a team, are reminding ourselves, like, you have to communicate to one another. Cause I think one of the biggest things with relinquishing control is that nobody knows who's actually doing
what.
It's, you know, finding ways to make that communication easier, more streamlined. So it's using project management software, making sure that it works and that people are using it, putting in notes. It's, you know, we use Slack for a lot of communication and just making sure that everybody's on the same page on how we communicate information about projects and where the shit is saved. And to Dustin's point, who's doing what, all that stuff has to be communicated, and it needs to be over communicated because everybody thinks that other people, I think, understand them more than what they actually do.
Yep.
And so it's, you really have to over communicate to communicate enough.
I know that people say mindset is everything.
Yeah.
And it sucks that it doesn't make sense until it clicks, until your mindset changes. And then you're like, oh, yeah, it is. Mindset is huge. And going from someone who like was afraid to reach out to studios, because year one of me going freelance, I worked with a studio twice. And on the second project, I screwed up. I overcommitted. I said I could do it. But I was so green in the industry that I didn't know what I could do.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just have to like, I'll stay up late and I'll get it done. And the day before it was due, I was like, hey guys, I don't know. I'm behind and I thought I could finish last night, but I'm totally not even close. And they were like, dude, we hired you because we don't have time to do this. It's a small project. And like, they kind of said, I could read between the lines, like, you screwed up, man. And I was like, I need to not ever reach out to studios until I get my shit together on my end. So I only reached out to direct clients that don't know anything about motion design. And I was playing it safe because I was so embarrassed. There was like a lot of shame in that, like feeling like I screwed up and I don't want to show my face in the industry again.
I spend the next 3 or 4 hours, I don't even remember, getting into the place where it can finally render. And I'm thinking, this is my life, man. It's 3 or 4 in the morning. I should be home. I should be with my family. I should just like, this can't be my life. And it was like, you know, sure, I have, quote, freedom, but I feel like sometimes I've built almost like a
slavery where you're a slave to the business.
Yeah, like I've built brick by brick this thing around me, and now I look around and I'm like, is this a jail cell or is this a, right?
Yep.
The door is always open. I can leave any time, but still I feel kind of trapped. And that was when I just basically made a decision the next day of, I've got to do something different.
For whatever reason, having a dedicated studio for hyper-focused motion has always been a goal of mine. A place where I could bring clients, show off our staff, show off the cool work, and just make it our own. But I wanted to know, did having an actual studio space become a benefit to a motion design studio?
I think that staying as small as you can for as long as you can in your startup phase is extremely important. Because I think when you start, all you have is overhead. You are nothing but overhead. And so keeping it as small and lean as you can is so crucial. And what I see a lot is, especially because like we're designers, so you want everything to look good.
Yeah.
So I think it's really easy to get caught up in, I've started a studio. I need to brand the studio. Therefore, I need to brand my space. I need to brand my surround. And you just like that, it starts to escalate so fast. And what I see a lot is like, I'll be like in a coffee shop or something. And I'll see a coffee shop that's like selling their own merch.
Yep.
But the shelves are entirely full because none of it is selling, because nobody is excited about your brand as you are. And that's fine. That is totally fine. But when I see that, it reminds me, you know what? A ladybird pin would be so cute. A whole set of ladybird pins would be the bomb. But I can't do that right now. I cannot do that right now. And so that reminder of just like staying small for a long time.
I think you might be close to selling some pins.
Yeah. I mean, just setting up the studio originally, it was really fun to get deliveries and like see our new couch together. It was weirdly like moving in a little while.
Yeah.
A little bit.
We got business married for sure.
We did.
That's what it is.
Oh, you also quickly learn that your tastes aren't necessarily everyone else's tastes.
If you don't have a creative mind, you might just be like, oh, okay, well, that's fine. That couch is a couch. But for us, we're like, no, this couch is a statement and it must reflect me, you know? So everything.
There's a lot of that. Yeah.
It just learning each other. Yeah. That is a big transition.
Was having a studio location, a physical building, brick and mortar, beneficial to Lemonly, or did it matter at all?
I think definitely in the formational years of a culture was super huge. So like we could be known as a good place to work, but you could really feel it, I think, when you came into the studio. And so I almost think in 2023 that might be less impactful,
mm-hmm.
because we've all gone to hybrid or more used to Zoom and remote. But in those teen years, it was pretty powerful, I think.
Did it make a difference for you guys?
I don't know that it did too much. I mean, people knew us a little bit more in Richmond, but not many of our clients were from Richmond at that point.
Actually, well, yeah, I guess you're right. But I will say that we had a very convenient location for some of the agencies that were in town or are in town. And so I think that just the fact that we were a block one way or the other from some of the bigger agencies, that felt like, yeah, we're in the walking zone. And so that means that they'll want to come over to our place. Because for a lot of, you know, a lot of agency people, they just need a break out of their place. And so they would come over and kind of hang out and watch, you know, the edit or whatever we're doing, get some snacks and then take off. So I think if we were any further out, they probably wouldn't have even bothered. I do believe that.
And then literally like days after that, we won Captain America Winter Soldier. And like, had we not been in this space, they would have probably not given us the job because there's no way we would have passed security. Winter Soldier was the first job we'd ever gotten at Marvel or at any kind of security, like required company.
Right,
so,
right.
When we got the like visual effects, you know, pipeline, we also got like the security mandates and they were like, you gotta be up to snuff like now and we will help you. But like, you gotta do it. You got like basically a couple of weeks and you're running. And you know, there's a lot of things like, oh, like windows can't be facing monitors. And, you know, if you're in a building with other tenants, there needs to be a certain kind of security at the door and things like that. So there were just things like that that our other space wasn't.
Right, right.
Where with having our own building, we could control the whole paradigm. So that's the thing about owning the space and having it be a space that's only you occupy, is that you can then control the space.
Hyperfocus Motion is not my first company. In fact, my wife and I ran 3-chord weddings, DJ, and photography for over a decade and had a lot of success doing it. However, we learned a lot about branding and marketing and finding your core values. So when Courtney and I started Hyperfocus Motion, I thought this was going to be a breeze. Wow, was I wrong. We had to learn so much about understanding our strengths, our positioning, and honestly, we're still figuring it out now. So I want to dive a little bit now into just finding out who you are as a business.
This sounds really gross, but like, get really intimate with your numbers, know what your numbers are, and know what your goals are too. And I think really what it comes down to is figuring out like, what do I want to make in a year? What's that goal? What does that mean every single month? And what does that mean from a services and capacity perspective? Yeah. So if I want to make $5,000 a month, how many sessions is that? You know, how much do I want to work? And it's first setting that up so you're not throwing spaghetti at the wall and you actually have like, okay, I want to book 4 sessions a month and they need to each be $1,500, whatever it might be. And then it's figuring out, okay, $1,500 a session, that's a little higher than what a lot of people are doing around here. How can I create a killer experience that makes people say worth it?
So it's the experience, not necessarily
the price tag. It's 100% the experience. It's never the price tag. If you have an issue with people not buying, you don't have a pricing issue. You probably have a brand issue.
You really have to just know, like, where with AJ knowing the numbers, like, it makes things a lot more clear. And so we know what our goals are.
Yeah.
We know what we have to hit from a sales perspective. And we know how do we get that? Well, we go through recurring clients, new clients. We have a little bit of a strategy. It's still something that's still being developed because him and I have finally, the past year, really gotten to be able to do some real business development.
Yeah.
So that's why we've been able to grow a little bit quicker.
I had to go through that process myself of figuring out that kind of that mental transition of, it's no longer my responsibility to be as palatable as possible to the entire world. That's not my job anymore. My job is to do work that I enjoy and that other people enjoy. And so it then became a process of, what work do I have that I would want to do again? And that's what's allowed to stay on the website. And that's the kind of stuff that's allowed to live here, because that's, you attract what you put out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So how long of freelancing did it take for you to go through that process?
It, I think, was ever evolving.
Yeah.
And that's what I had to tell myself, I think, to get started, was that nothing's permanent. And I think without that thought, I wouldn't have started, because I'm very much usually in this mindset of, everything has to be perfect before I can start. Nothing, everything's permanent. Everything has to be right before I begin. And that's not true. And so once I kind of realized that like Lady Bird is a living, breathing thing, it was so much easier to start knowing I can always adjust later on down the line. Everything is flexible.
And ask them questions, bounce ideas off of each other. And I think that's the really important part of running a business, is continually learning and communicating with people in a way that helps not only promote their business, but your business as well. And I think it's important to promote their business too.
Often I'm asked by contemporaries out there that are thinking about starting their own business, they'll call and be like, hey, can I have like an informational interview with you and just kind of pick your brain?
Yeah.
They're like, I want to make a company just like yours and compete against you. And I'm like, okay, what do you want to know? And they're like asking all of these questions, but they never ask like the one question that's like the most important question is how are you going to get work? Where's the work going to come from? And I always like lob that out there and I'm like, okay, well, where's the work coming from? Do you have like clients that are ready to start tossing stuff your way or what? And it's shocking the number of how very little thought is given to this sometimes before people start a business. I think people think they're going to put a website out there
and everyone's going to care.
Everybody's going to care.
Yep.
And let me tell you, nobody's going to care.
Yep.
Nobody's going to give a fuck. Yep. No matter how beautiful your work is. Even if you sell amazing NFTs, nobody's going to care because in the commercial world, it's like track record and relationships and kind of proving yourself over and over and over again, small scale to grow to large scale.
Day one, like I said, we have to be brand forward. We can't afford it right now, so I'll make a quick little logo.
Yeah.
So I made this really bad 12 Midnight Visual Makers logo. We were trying to be all thoughtful. And it was this thing that was like it worked for what we were doing at the time, right? And it looked good enough. And so we knew, like, as soon as we had enough funding or if we had enough dollars in the door, then we wanted to go back to Gigantic, I worked with, and we wanted them to do our brand. It wasn't cheap for us, especially at the time, you know, and I think, like, we really put everything that we had into the brand, into the website, and into, like, getting those assets that we need to be able to polish it. And then the polish has been the work over the past year and a half, 2 years that we've had it, the outside, you know, making our stuff stand out, making us, our messaging clear, you know, and putting our website in a position to be looked at as like, oh, well, this company's been around a long time when really at the time we hadn't been.
Right.
That's the original Full Harbor. So my motion design company now is called Full Harbor.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
But my leather company was called Full Harbor. It was great for like branding, figuring out marketing, products, customer service, and fulfillment.
Sales. And this was, yards.
Yeah. So this was
the idea of a business.
It was all before I went freelance. So that gave me a ton of experience with customers. The branding changed, but the name, since the leather business, I just let it die. the name is just so great. My last name is Sailor. Harbor is a place of business, and when the harbor is full, that means business is good.
It's like all these perfect touch points.
Yeah, like I gotta use it. So I took it.
Because that branding is just, it's on lockdown.
Thank you.
It is nice.
Thank you.
Was it nice day one?
I will say, I think I had a very clear vision of it from the beginning. It was more so just like, it's like when you have a dream and you're trying to like talk about it. And so that was, I think the big challenge was I had the picture, but I just needed to nail down the vibe and what vibe did I want to live with for a very long time. And so I was really lucky. I think that all the sketches look very much the same. It was just fine tuning.
That's the hard thing to achieve.
It really was.
I think one of the biggest benefits as a freelancer or starting your own company is understanding what the need is that you are trying to convey to someone else.
Yeah.
It's not always visual, but sometimes it's communicative. And I think at the base of design work, it's about your business goals and your business values and your messaging and how you talk with your employees and what the expectations are of those employees. Like that's a brand. And design is secondary. If it wasn't for businesses, I wouldn't exist. Like, there's like that sort of thing where like I would exist, but I wouldn't be doing what I do.
Right.
I would say, conceptually speaking, as a matter of principle, I find that great marketing is all about creating curiosity that leads to a conversation. But yes, at some point there is it's like a mental funnel. It's like a brain funnel where great positioning is going to make me curious. Huh. What's that? It makes me say, huh, I'm getting a sense of something. Plus it's paired with a visual. If I'm that kind of person, huh, well, what is that? Okay. That's a win. I mean, that is great positioning right from the start. But to your point, it's not enough because you've made me curious, but I'm pretty soon, once I start scrolling down that page or I click on the about and I go to the about, I want you to also just tell me what the heck is it you do?
Right, right.
And if you don't tell me that, I'm going to be frustrated. I'm going to say,
I don't get it.
I don't get it. That's odd. That's confusing. So it's this idea of step one. It's usually this why. It's this mission, this purpose. It's an aspiration. It might be a rallying cry. It might be an anthem. And coming up with that is so damn hard. But yes, that thing is going to make you curious. And then as you gradually are exposed to, well, who are these people and what are they about? And what is it they actually do and how do they do it? And those answers become increasingly literal. So that by the time you get to the bottom of this funnel, you kind of know why this company exists, but you also know what they do, how they do it, who they are. Like, oh, this is Dryson. This is, you know, his team. These are the, like, okay. And so when I get to the contact page and I see executive producer, right, Susie Smith or whatever, it's like, that's a real person and I can click on that and it's going to send a real email to somebody on the other end named Susie who's going to answer my question and start helping me figure out how to get my project done.
It just took me a while to realize what sales actually was and our approach to sales. It's not me, us. It's like, what do you need? And what do you guys do? And like, I didn't get that for a while. I started reading a lot of books. I started speaking with my husband, who's like really good at sales. And the irony is that he was like, you don't sell when you do sales. You listen, you ask questions, you talk, you communicate, you build relationships. And I'm like, but how do you get the sale? When's the selling? And he was like, you're not getting it. So I had to read some books and finally it started clicking for me.
The hardest thing about these type of our businesses is sort of the volatile nature of the work met with the way you try to build the consistency of the workforce. Well, and what you'll find is it becomes this cycle. So like you'll fix a problem in your business and it'll probably create another problem. And I mean, good problems. So we are really focusing on marketing. I'm doing a podcast. More people need to know about my studio. Okay, great. Now all these people are calling us. So it's sales is pretty busy because shit, I got to send all these proposals and I got to answer these phone calls. I got to get back to him. Okay, you fix that. You've closed more proposals. Okay, so now you got to go do the work, right? And so you have a delivery challenge and then you get it all done. Maybe you need to hire more people because you're so busy.
Right.
Well, then you need more sales, right? And so it does create this cycle. But if you think of it that way, it's like, I'm going to break this intentionally and then I'll fix it. It'll break the next thing. And we're just going to keep spinning this cycle and like kind of moving it faster and moving it bigger.
Like sales. Yeah, of course. Like sales is a big part of that. It's like breaking that feast or famine cycle where it's like you're busy slammed doing this one project and then you can't think about anything else. And therefore you can't sell.
You can't do the marketing, get to the selling.
You can't line up the next thing. And, you know, like, let's say my primary responsibility these days is sales. It wouldn't even be possible for me to spend time doing that if I didn't have
operations,
team,
finance,
right? Like the operations is handled and the billing is handled and, you know, the work is getting done. I don't know how you do that without a team of people. You know, it's very difficult. I mean, I think you can, but it's sort of like if you're a freelancer or if you're, you know, let's say like, I want to be a company of two forever. I think that's fine, but you really have to put some rails on that.
Yeah.
You know, like when things are going fantastic, like it's amazing, you know, and like people are calling and it's cool projects and like sometimes we get to turn down things because we're like, we have a choice of things we could work on right now. And then other times it's like, oh man, like we don't have anything coming in and like everything's about to wrap. Like, so I feel better because I feel like I put a lot of the right people in the right place. You know, I can trust that like any job that comes in, I can step to the side and be like, yeah, we're still busy right now, but we need to focus on business because I know in like another 2 months, we don't have anything on the docket. Right.
Right.
And that's the hardest thing about being like a service-based place, unless you have like retainers. Like we have one retainer client, but like outside of that, it's just incredibly hard to know what's coming in.
Once again, I want to say thank you so much for being a part of the Frame One journey. This is our season finale. So what's next? Frame One is taking a hiatus for a little while because this show has been quite expensive to produce, to be honest with you, and it is a major time commitment. I love it. It is one of my favorite endeavors that I've taken on to date. So will there be more episodes? Absolutely. As I travel the country and meet with different studio owners, we're going to record as many Frame One episodes as I can from here until I can't do it anymore. But they will not be released on a month-by-month-by-month basis anymore. So keep an eye out, follow along. If you have any questions, reach out to me at Dryson at wearehyperfocused.com. And again, I just want to say thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you for making this last year incredible, either by being on the show or reaching out and telling me how much the show has helped you. You are appreciated.